Man's nightmare this morning. Forgive my voice, but I'm sure Michael will cope, and if he and I don't between us, then Mervyn will take over. So that should guarantee me an audience of one. He'll have to listen. Would you be good enough just to turn back to Luke chapter 19? We're starting what the television would no doubt call a mini-series over this Easter, as we look in the morning at Luke's account of the last days of Jesus, and in the evening at John's. And we're focusing on what Dr. Luke has to say to us. We've called the series Postmortem, and of course there's something in that. Doctors are rarely eyewitnesses of deaths that they investigate, are they? And Luke is no exception. Yet I'm constantly amazed by what doctors are able to discover. It's interesting, isn't it, with the wonders of modern technology, what they've discovered in Ireland about these two men who are accused of the dreadful murder of those soldiers. If what was claimed in court the other day is true, then from bits of glass and from wool fibres, they've been able to implicate these two men. Now, Luke, of course, has none of that modern technology, but then he has no need for it either. We ask of him, I take it, what he as a competent investigator claims to have done, to interview those who were there at the time and who saw the events, to establish what happened and why, and then to tell it, so that we can get the message. And that's what Luke says he set out to do as he wrote his gospel. And we're going to start as we investigate the death of Jesus back in Luke chapter 19, because the death didn't happen out of the blue. You can't just start with the events of that IRA funeral and say two soldiers turned up at a funeral and were lynched and think you've understood it. There's a whole history, isn't there, of background which led to that tragedy. Well, Luke's whole gospel is trying to prepare us to understand the events of next Friday, so to speak. Jesus has been heading towards Jerusalem since chapter 9. And yet we can come in here, and I think we'll still pick up sufficient clues. Luke does not make the mistake of thinking, because he's told us something once, we've understood it. You know the way parents say, how many times do I have to tell you, dear? I chuckle to myself when I hear myself saying exactly the lines that exasperated me when my mother said them to me. How many times do I have to tell you, dear? Luke's answer is as many as possible. Then you might stand a chance of understanding it. And so as he tells the story of Palm Sunday, he recaptures a number of the themes that have been echoing around his gospel. And it becomes another outing for them. And we'll pick some of them up this morning. So Luke chapter 19, verse 28 is where we begin. And the first thing we're going to try and grasp and glimpse are these cheering crowds. That's verses 28 to 40. When he'd said this, when Jesus had told a remarkable parable, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. It is the last lap of the journey. And for once, Jesus is happy to go public. There's something quite unambiguous, isn't there, about this entry to Jerusalem. It's a sovereign, openly striding towards his capital city. That's the impact of this paragraph. For once, there's nothing hidden. It's all out in the open. You see, almost every little incident in this paragraph is making the same point. There's the instructions to the disciples in verses 29 to 32 about finding this young ass. And you see the summary, verse 32, so those who were sent went away and found it as he had told them. Exactly as he told them. That's the thrust of it. Here's a sovereign, and things are in his control. They're just as he says they'll be. Then verses 33 and 34, as they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, why are you untying the colt? Fairly natural reaction, isn't it, if you see someone taking your donkey away? And they said, the Lord has need of it. Well, many's the commentator that suggests this little phrase, the Lord has need of it, was a kind of password. That the owners were friends of Jesus, and this was the kind of password. Well, it may be, but if it is, it's not lost its significance the moment it's said here. It's the password for all friends of Jesus, isn't it? I take it whatever possessions we have, if we claim to be disciples, here's the password that releases them. Here's the acid test of my attitude to them, isn't it? The Lord has need of it, they're surrendered. Even if it's just a young ass. And I'm so poor I can only be a part owner. Did you notice that? It was the owners in the plural. Whether I'm poor or affluent, this password still applies. It's a king's password. He's acting like one. Then, verse 35, they brought it to Jesus, and throwing their garments on the colt, they set Jesus upon it. Here are the disciples paying their homage to their king. And as he rode along, they spread their garments on the road. Well, now you know that Sir Walter Raleigh read the Bible as well. What passage he had in Daily Bread Notes that morning. See, as he was drawing near, and now the pace increases. They come down the Mount of Olives. The crowds grow. Look, there's whole multitudes of disciples. The common memories begin to play, don't they? They remember the mighty works they'd seen. Lazarus raised, Bartimaeus gets his sight back. And what does it lead? Why, it leads to what so often happens when there's crowds. They're chanting, they're singing. Now, even English fans, I'm told, were singing at the Rugby International last Saturday. Sorry, Irish people, but it doesn't happen very often. Even the Englishmen found something to shout about. Well, here's what they're shouting, and of course, it's something far more solemn than he'll never walk alone. Blessed, verse 38, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. That's their slogan. It's a straight quote from the Psalms. It's a messianic quote. It's speaking of God's King. He'll come in the name of the Lord as God's representative, as God's agent, as God's envoy, as God's Messiah King. Here's the one. He'll bring God's peace. Well, there's no doubt this is a very public entry. And then those last two verses. You see, here's the one false note of the afternoon. There always is in the crowds, isn't it? It's not just a few arrests. No, here's the Pharisees. They're in the multitude. They hear what's being said. They know perfectly well what's meant. There's no way you can stop a crowd, so you go for the head man, and they go straight to Jesus, and they say, Teacher, rebuke your disciples. You can't possibly let them call you Messiah, can you? You can't be wanting to say that. Well, I take it that's where their main eye is. I suspect another one is on the Roman garrison. When you're an occupied country, it's not a very sensible thing to hail a king with the garrison just at the top of the hill. Teacher, rebuke your disciples. And look at Jesus' answer. See, again, I've heard it said more than once that this Palm Sunday event, it was something like the force of circumstances. You know, we can't be sure whether Jesus wanted this kind of acclamation or not. I should have thought in Luke's account there is no doubt whatsoever. In fact, I'm sure that's why he adds these last two verses. He's the one who does. He wants us to get the picture very clearly. Jesus is going public. He is entering as the Messiah King. So Luke records how the Pharisees come up and say, Jesus, tell them to shut up. And Jesus says, don't be silly. Don't be ridiculous. I tell you, if these were silent, the very stones would cry out. Can't you see it so obvious? No, there's to be no doubting that this is the King who's coming. Well, says Luke, get that picture clear in our minds. Here's the cheering crowds. They speak of a royal procession. But then notice what follows immediately afterwards. You see, it's a remarkable paragraph. Because the cheering crowds are followed by a weeping king. Indeed, it's going on at the same time. Verse 41, when he drew near and saw the city, Jesus wept over it. It's hard to put the two together, isn't it? This tremendous shouting and chanting and praising. And then the one around whom it all revolves, sobbing. The word for wept there speaks not so much of tears, but of sobs, great heaving sobs. It's a very powerful word. And we come here with one of the most terrible pronouncements of judgment that Jesus makes. And it's delivered with sobs. Please, please notice that. Don't let us ever get glib about God's judgment. Don't let's ever do it from great security of it's not going to hit me, so I can say it lightly to someone else. I take it this is the true pastor's heart. This is actually the true Christian's heart, isn't it? He's sobbing not for himself that he's about to be rejected, though he knows that and he knows what it'll mean. Just look back to the top of page 78. He knows when he gets to Jerusalem, he's going to be, in the words of verse 32 of chapter 18, he's going to be delivered to the Gentiles. He'll be mocked and shamefully treated and spit upon, and they'll scourge him and kill him. But that's not who the sobs are for. The sobs are for those who'll do the rejecting. We were just at the end of last week looking at working out the Sunday card for the next few months. And I was talking with someone and they said to me, "Oh dear, I dread these guest services." As they saw we were planning on another evangelistic weekend. And they said, "Yes, it's all the sweat you go to of inviting someone and then the frustration and the despair when they don't come or they aren't interested." I knew exactly what they were talking about. I felt with them and for them. And then I came home and read these words again. And I realized that we've got to say to ourselves, look, let's spare ourselves the self-pity and the self-sympathy. Our rejection really is nothing. It's their rejection that's lethal. And as I looked at this, I thought, yes, I must keep my tears for those who need them. And it's not me if my friends don't want to hear the message. Well, when Jesus drew near, when he saw this capital city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that even today you knew the things that make for peace." You see, when he comes to Jerusalem, he discovers here's a city. They don't really know what peace is all about. They pray regularly for peace in Jerusalem. But they've not understood the peace that God's bringing and offering and promising. And if they don't understand the message, they'll never recognize the messenger. And that's been the case all the way through the gospel. See, there aren't many amongst the religious community who are like the Simeons that Luke tells of right at the beginning of his gospel, who holds the baby Jesus in his arm and praises God because mine eyes have seen your salvation. There aren't many Annas in Luke's gospel who comes to the temple at the same time as the baby Jesus and sees and believes and goes around telling of him to everyone who's concerned for the redemption of Israel. "Would that even today," says Jesus, "you knew the things that make for peace." Would that even today, when We put all the wraps off and I'm coming as the Messiah King, openly and plainly. Would that you'd grasp it now, it wouldn't be too late. But it's already obvious that they won't. I take it verses 39 and 40 are merely confirming the worst fears. No, what he knew anyway. They're set on their course. And you'll see over the next few pages of Luke's Gospel that the course is very clearly marked. All the powers that be have made up their mind. Look, verse 47, at the end of this chapter. He was teaching daily in the temple, and the chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people sought to destroy him. By the way, notice in these references how it is the leaders who are always doing it. They didn't find anything they could do, for all the people hung upon his words. Then turn over the page to verse 19 of chapter 20. See, the scribes and the chief priests tried to lay hands on him at that very hour, but they feared the people. Or on again to chapter 22. See verse 2, the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people. They were plotting. It wasn't a question of whether, it was just when and how. And the next verse, they got their opportunity. Judas comes to betray them. So over and on to the end of chapter 23, the same picture comes with the arrest and the trials. Chapter 23, verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. And he says to them, I'm going to release him. And verse 18, they all cried out together, away with this man, release to us Barabbas. You see the importance, do you, of the leaders. And when the leaders reject the Messiah, we've got to disassociate ourselves from them. Or we get caught up with them. Well, back to what Jesus has to say. Would that even today you knew the things that make for peace. But now, and this I think is the most striking of his sentences, now, he says, they're hid from your eyes. Now, he's saying, it really is too late. Now the moment's come and gone. Now there'll be no more chance to see them. Now the course is inexorably set. See, he's suggesting, isn't he, that God doesn't actually wait forever. Now, I have to be careful. I am not Jesus. I cannot say to any individual, these things are hid from your eyes. You'll never see them. But by the same token, I cannot reassure anyone and say, well, it doesn't matter, you've got plenty of time. Any time you choose to turn, God will be waiting for you. I can't make that promise. Something rather chilling, isn't it, when I discover that actually the timing isn't in my hands. There's an awful urgency that creeps in. I suddenly realize how dangerous it is to listen to a sermon. It's not that God will always be there when I turn to him. And you see, he's suggesting that it is now too late for those in Jerusalem. And there comes this awful picture in verses 43 and 44 as he looks ahead to what will be their ultimate fate, and indeed what was. Their utter destruction. It's not a picture of defeat, is it? It is of total destruction. Those cheering crowds, no doubt some of them not understanding really what's going on, thinking at last, here's the one who'll put Jerusalem on the map. And Jesus opens his mouth and says, no, listen, Jerusalem is about to be wiped right off the map. Because you did not know, verse 44, the time of your visitation. You didn't know it. He's harking right back to what was said at the beginning of his gospel. Luke chapter 1. Just look it up now. Someone won't need to look it up. Luke chapter 1 verse 68. Anyone apart from Renette Roberts know what it means? Know what it says? learnt it some time ago. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people. That's what's said. That's what Zechariah says when he understands the meaning of the birth of Jesus. God's coming to visit and redeem his people. Now you see that tremendous prophecy right, I was going to say before the whole thing started, but of course it wasn't. It's picked up here, isn't it? And it's as if as Jesus comes to Jerusalem, he says, God has come, God has visited, God is going to redeem, and you never noticed it. Don't let's ever say ignorance is bliss. Ignorance is a very dangerous thing in the Bible. At least to be ignorant of the things of God, and to be ignorant of the people of God, and to be ignorant of God's Messiah, it can't be more dangerous. Here are these people, they've had the whole of the Old Testament revelation. They've seen the mighty works that caused the crowds to praise, and they've refused to accept their opportunity. Because that's what the word time means. You didn't know the opportunity of your visitation. You only came here today because someone asked you. Just coming to church, never dawned on you that it was an opportunity for redemption. Suddenly the whole thing is more serious, isn't it? So here's the second picture, a king weeping for the willful, deliberate, blinding ignorance of his people. Now, see, these things say a lot about what's going to happen at the end of the week. I have to be very careful, don't I, before I start talking about an innocent, naive Jesus caught up in a web of politics that got out of control. That's not the way Luke presents him at all. The Jesus who knows perfectly well what's going on. Oh yes, I expect when I've read this second paragraph, I'm expecting some very unking-like moments ahead. Good Friday will be an awful tragedy, won't it? It'll be the killing of God's king. But that won't make it a tragic accident. Jesus is going into it with eyes open. And I take it from this that I'm not to expect things to end with the cross. See, what do these verses of judgment imply? They imply that a city that misses its moment, that doesn't know its visitor, that rejects its Messiah, won't find that that's the end of the story. It won't find that. You can't get rid of God's Messiah that easily. Our rejection is followed by another. I can refuse a Savior King. But nothing can help me escape the judge. This Messiah King will be vindicated. Now you see, let's just come back and look at what we've seen again. Let's put these two things together. I found it quite remarkable as I thought about this. The cheering crowds on the one hand, the weeping king on the other. What a striking contrast they make. And actually how clearly they point to another feature. The strange kingdom that is God's kingdom. See, think of the two together. Here's the king. That's clear, isn't it? That couldn't be said more plainly. And yet, where is he king? Jesus is very insistent he's king. But equally clear that it's not here. It's not in this Jerusalem. Why? There won't be one stone left upon another. You see, Luke is trying to tell us, isn't he, very plainly, that his kingdom is not a kingdom of this Jerusalem, but of the Jerusalem that's above. All the Gospels are insistent on making this point. I take it this is Luke's equivalent of what John makes when he quotes those words of Jesus, "My kingdom is not of this world." I don't know whether Mervyn will be taking that exact saying tonight, but he won't be able to avoid the theme. It's there in all the Gospels. What a vivid way Luke tells it, isn't it? Here's the king coming to the capital city, and he gets there and says, "No, actually there won't be anything of this left." You see, what's going to happen at the end of the week? That cross is going to distinguish between this Jerusalem and the Jerusalem above. That cross, it's going to be the mark, isn't it, of the judgment of this world, and this Jerusalem, if you like, on Jesus, as well as the judgment on this world and this Jerusalem. The two aren't related. That's why the way of the kingdom way, is the way of the cross. Luke has Jesus saying it two times in his gospel. "Unless you'll take up your cross, you can't be my disciple. Unless you'll take up your cross daily, you can't follow me. Unless you're willing to tread this remarkable otherworldly path, you've got it wrong. You're not following the king." The fact that I cheer and I sing the hymns one day is no guarantee I won't back off it the next. Now, what I've been struggling with this week is this. Why is Luke so anxious to tell me this? You see, I never came to his gospel thinking that Jesus could possibly be the king of the Jews in the literal sense and the king of this Jerusalem. That wasn't my starting point. I can understand how they might have thought he was going to be that kind of rescuer. But why labour the point? I haven't told you anything new so far when I've said this. And I take it that Luke and the other gospel writers labour the point because they know that I will be constantly tempted to act as if Jesus is the king of this world. As if Jesus is the king of this Jerusalem, rather. As if this is where the kingdom is. When I read the rest of the New Testament, I see that's where its warnings lie as well. See, it's easy to point the finger, isn't it, at the extreme sort of social gospel liberation theology people, at the health and wealth boys, and say, yes, they need to be reminded the kingdom isn't in this Jerusalem. We'll never build Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant lands, at least not in the sense that Blake meant it. But it's closer home than that. I take it that here is Luke's equivalent of all of the teaching in the epistles about how we need to make sure we're not earthly minded. We're not this world centered. See, why do you get, and you get it strongly in Luke's gospel, but why do you get throughout the New Testament the warnings to rich people? Haven't come across one yet. Maybe there, but I haven't come across it yet that tells me how dangerous it is to be poor. Keeps telling me there's big dangers if I'm rich. And the big danger is that I can easily think that it's all to do with this Jerusalem. Because I can get the kingdom very comfortable. Or let's just move away from the straight possessions thing. These are simply some of my applications I've been thinking about. They may not be right. You'll need to test them. Let's take families. Families bringing up young children in London. And the whole question of education. Now don't misunderstand me. I am not saying we should not think ahead about education or care for it. I'm very conscious that the problem hasn't quite hit us yet. Anna is still too young. Her thoughts, she needs it. Very striking yesterday, she tried to get into a dress that she finally was convinced was too small for her, and she said, "Yes, I know I'm too big for it now, but when I get smaller, I'll be able to get into it again." She needs education, all right. But listen, isn't it a big problem? Doesn't it so easily grip the minds of parents? You see, Of course we want the best for children. We want to open up the future at least as best possible for them. When does the point come? When does the point come when the whole problems of academic qualifications and openings for the future get so strong, I've also got to remember the kingdom is not in this Jerusalem? How do I teach that to my child as well? How do I show that as I wrestle with those kind of issues? Or while I'm treading on eggshells, let's go the whole way. Let's take another one. Let's take the whole factor of bereavement. And death. We'll make it death of a Christian friend or relative or family member. Again, don't mishear me. I'm not saying that there should be no tears. I'm also conscious, again, I've not had to personally face it, at least not with someone really close. Both my parents are still alive. My friends, close friends, are still young enough and fortunate enough not to have died. But there comes a moment, doesn't there, in the sort of shock and the horror of loss, when I've also got to say this, the kingdom isn't in this Jerusalem. Isn't that the thrust of what Paul says to those Christians when he says, I wouldn't have you grieve as those without hope. It doesn't say I wouldn't have you grieve. But he does say I wouldn't have you grieve as those without hope. As those for whom this Jerusalem was all there is, then death really is the end. See, our fond ambitions for our children are fond hopes with our friends and family become something of an acid test, doesn't it? Or let's take religion. That may or may not be safer. But I take it it's still constantly an area where, and you see, this is the supreme irony, isn't it? This is Jesus' big hassle with the religious people of his day. It's constantly bringing it down to this Jerusalem instead of the Jerusalem above. Why are the priests so threatened by this Messiah coming? I take it one reason is they'd be out of a job. Notice what happens immediately at the end of this chapter. He's driving the people out of the temple. He's insistent that it's about prayer and then teaching. Not about empire building. How easy it is to do that and forget the purposes. Or turn over one page and look, here's one of the reasons he got himself crucified, if I can put it that way. Human level it is. End of chapter 20, verse 46. He said in the hearing of all the people, beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and love salutations in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They love the people to come up to them in the marketplace and say, good morning, Father. They love people to treat them with great deference. They love the attention of this world. They want the focus to be on them. By the way, doesn't it say we've got to work out sooner or later what we do about the long robes we dress ourselves in? I mean, I take it this verse tells me it's very dangerous for me to dress myself up as Mervyn is this morning. I do it too. I take it it's very dangerous for you if we dress ourselves up like this and you seem to think that we're the people that matter. No, the kingdom is not in this Jerusalem. It's above. So don't let's forget Luke's Palm Sunday contrast. The cheering crowds. The weeping king. And together they make this vivid way of teaching this lesson about a strange kingdom. Very strange to the way we naturally think and act. But if I've not learnt the lesson, I'll never understand the events of Friday. Let's pray. Would that even today you knew the things that make for peace. Father, in your mercy, give us eyes that can see them and minds that can grasp those things that make for peace. And give us the wills to follow and obey the King of the Cross, for Jesus' sake. Amen.